Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the government shutdown and the blame game underway, with President Trump calling for the nuclear option in the Senate to take away the filibuster from the Democrats and leave them completely powerless in the face of a thuggish, uncompromising, and unyielding Republican House and Senate and a criminally incompetent president. Jim Manley, a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate who served as the senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years and before that 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy, joins us. We'll discuss the Republican finger-pointing at Senator Schumer and the feigned indignation coming from Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has shut the Democrats out of any negotiation. And when they have been let in on a bipartisan basis, they soon find themselves hung out to dry and jilted by a joke of a president who does not know what he wants and is easily swayed by the hawkish hardliners he listens to, Stephen Miller and his chief of staff, General Kelly. Then we'll assess the growing crisis with two NATO allies at loggerheads as Turkish jets pound the US's Kurdish allies in the Syria-Turkey border area, while Turkey surrogates the Free Syrian Army, along with Turkish troops, launch a ground offensive. Max Hoffman, the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, joins us to discuss the dictator of Turkey's Erdogan's vow to strangle this force at birth, meaning the Syrian Kurdish military force the U.S. has backed and wants to maintain as a long-term military presence in the region. Then finally, we will speak with Kent Harrington, a former senior CIA analyst who served as the National Intelligence Officer for East Asia. He joins us to discuss his article at MediaVillage.com, why the news needs to deconstruct Trump's dangerous jingoism, and how much the North Koreans have done an end run around Trump's belligerent rhetoric by sending their Olympians to compete in the Winter Games under a common flag, with their pre-Olympic delegation to Seoul, led by a North Korean pop singer who has created a K-pop media frenzy in the South. And joining us now is Jim Manley, a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Manley.
Thanks for having me on again, Ian.
Well, thank you, Jim. And the Senate resumed at 1 p.m. Eastern today.
Yep.
They're back in session at about 18 minutes in. Senator Schumer called Trump a dysfunctional president. He can't take yes for an answer. And he's walked away from two bipartisan deals on the DACA fix. How much is this resonating, given our bifurcated media in this country with this massive cleavage where you've got 30 to 35% of the country immune to facts and evidence listening to Fox News?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a couple different ways to answer that question. One way to answer it is that both of the parties' respective bases are very comfortable with what's going on right now. And the question is, what impact, if any, that's going to have on what I assume are going to be some legitimate negotiations at some point to once again kick the can down the road. So both parties, I think, looking at their base, feel pretty good. What I'm here to argue for is that Democrats, looking at the META issue, should feel very comfortable engaging in this kind of a process. After all, enough is enough. The administration has claimed to want to deal with the Dreamers issue. They haven't done it yet. They claim to want to pass a CHIP bill to help provide health care to young kids, a bill that I worked on when I worked for the late Senator Kennedy, obviously near and dear to my heart. And so I think the politics for Democrats are going to play out just fine in the end. It doesn't mean that things aren't going to get ugly, depending on how long this goes. I mean, you saw this ad put out by President Trump's campaign last night where, in using incredibly vile and racist language, they accused Democrats of being responsible for the idea that illegal immigrants are killing American citizens, completely beyond the pale. So it's going to get ugly, but, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, the 2018 election, as far as I can tell, based on everything I know so far, is going to be about President Trump. And so I would, again, that again leads me to suggest that the politics for the Democrats are going to be just fine in the end.
But does this situation require Trump, or can McConnell and Schumer work this out?
No, I mean, in years past, we had two strong, you know, we had leaders that knew how to legislate, for instance, in Harry Reid and Speaker Pelosi, working with their, you know, counterparts in the Republican Party could get stuff done, but it always required, you know, the active engagement of the president, in this particular instance, President Obama. We now have two incredibly weak leaders in Ryan and McConnell. Ryan, of course, is always looking over his right shoulder, facing a challenge from the hardcore conservatives. McConnell, you know, largely the same thing, though, you know, completely unwilling to take on the president, stand up to the president when he sees him go crazy. So with two incredibly weak leaders, the only way anything's going to get done is with the active engagement of the president. The problem, of course, and has been well documented over the last 24, 48 hours, McConnell himself has said no one has any idea what the president wants, and which, again, is not helping the process or the negotiations. And maybe more importantly, number two, it, so far at least, this so-called brilliant negotiator, the best deal maker ever, whatever the hell he calls himself, he's been unwilling to get his fingers dirty and wrap his arms around any sort of deal. As soon as they get close, he runs away and says sends his chief of staff back to tell Schumer, no. He didn't really mean what he said. There is no deal. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But it's I do not feel sorry, needless to say, for either McConnell or Ryan. But when you have a president that's so abjectly incompetent when it comes to legislating, ditto for his team, it does make things a little bit more difficult, no doubt about it.
And it's not just you and I that feel that way, Jim. Senator Lindsey Graham has pointed out that he blames a possible shutdown, or the shutdown itself, I guess, on Trump listening to Tom Cotton, Stephen Miller, and we know that chief of staff is a real hardliner as well on immigration. And again, I'm speaking with Jim Manley, who's the senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. The only thing that I wonder about is, in terms of the optics and the blame game, is that the Republicans are pounding this idea that all the Democrats care about is illegal immigrants and they don't care about Americans, and that this is all going to hurt the military, and the hordes of illegals are going to be pouring across the border because we haven't built the wall. My sense is that when Chuck Schumer said that in the meeting with Trump, where he said he even put the wall on the table, I can't understand why anybody would do that. I know it's a negotiating tactic, but to my mind, if we as a nation lose our mind and waste money on such a monstrously stupid adventure, which the Mexicans were supposed to pay for, mm-hmm. I mean, to my mind, the Democrats have a stronger argument, which is, this is insane. This is a massive waste of money. And by the way, the Mexicans are supposed to pay for it. There's no way in the world we're going to be held hostage to something stupid like that when DACA doesn't cost any money. It's just reassuring a bunch of kids in this country that they're not going to get deported. That doesn't take. That's not a heavy lift.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, Ian. I had a conversation, a private conversation with Congressman Gutierrez last night. Well, I guess getting ready to do TV, and we talked exactly about that. He, over the last 24 hours, has indicated that DACA is his biggest priority, and if Democrats have to concede on funding for the so-called wall, he was, in fact, willing to do so. You know, I don't know where to begin. I've represented immigration groups in the past. It is very clear that you know, there's already a massive militarization along the border. that you know, obviously the we've done a better job in recent years keeping out those that are trying to get in. But I just haven't made a decision. I mean, I just want to get a deal that helps these folks, the so-called dreamers. So I agree with you that it's outrageous, wasteful spending. The problem is that, you know, Democrats have supported it in the past as part of so-called border security. So having said that, to be clear, that is one of the things that is going on as we speak. You said earlier that the Senate's back in session. That's, in fact, correct. The House is coming back shortly. Not a lot of stuff going on publicly, but privately, you know, I've made some phone calls up the Hill. There's a lot of conversations going on, so-called moderates or what's left of them, and both the Democrats and the Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans are going in and out of each other's offices, trying to see if they can cut a quote-unquote deal that they can show their leaders later on. Whether that leads to anything, I don't know. They are trying to work something out that goes beyond, you know, the just additional extra funding to deal with some of these other issues, including DACA, the CHIP program, et cetera. But it looks like, having said that, I mean, we're on a path because Republicans don't know how to legislate, that there's going to be a vote in the next couple of days to extend this process for just another 3 weeks to try and sort all this things out. And it's just crazy. I mean, Republicans control both the House and the Senate and the White House, of course, and they can't get anything done. It's just a pathetic indictment of that party.
But is it now it being captured by the very people who don't want to get anything done? The Koch brothers who fund the Tea Party, or the so-called Freedom Caucus?
Oh, yeah, I mean, we could spend hours talking about that. Those folks, those outside groups, including the so-called Tea Party activists, have corrupted that party, the party of, you know, states' rights, for instance. Time and time again is running over states to try and deal with some of these different issues. So, I mean, the party itself is morally corrupt and is veering in a very dangerous direction. Obviously, I'm biased, or we're both biased, but I think we both believe that. And no better manifestation is that, is, again, as we've mentioned, Stephen Miller, among others in that White House. I mean, hardline nativists time this president moves towards cutting the deal, they rein him back. So,
right, but you have to add General Kelly to that. I mean,
no disagreement. I publicly voiced criticism of General Kelly when he was first selected, in part because I'm very concerned about this idea that this administration is so heavily populated with military figures. You know, don't get me wrong. You know, there's a role for leadership. You know, their leadership qualities and skills, but it's a little too much. But he's been an absolute disaster as a chief of staff. There is, as of, you know, whatever time it is right now, he is by far the worst chief of staff that I've ever seen, and that includes Reince Priebus.
Well, again, it seems to me to be an issue. This government's being shut down over a battle between the Republicans, who say they need to solve a problem that's already been solved, which is border security, and the Democrats, who are saying, you won't let us even solve the problems that you keep promising to solve, which is CHIPS and DACA.
Yep.
And when you look at the border situation, first of all, there's some ugly stuff going on. Not only did Trump choose Kelly to be Homeland Security because of his hardline immigration views, already within INS and ICE, et cetera, you've got them rounding up all kinds of people, including activists. Immigrants' rights activists are being rounded up. And you've got the situation where you cannot spend any more money on the Border Patrol. They already have more money than they know what to do with. They've had to lower their standards allowing people in. They've got more personnel than they can handle. And tons of money under Obama has been spent on drones and sensors, et cetera. So that is a problem that's already been solved. The bigger problems about comprehensive immigration haven't even been looked at. So, again, I don't know whether you can make an argument, a rational, reasonable, intelligent argument for the American people to understand what's really going on here is one party is beating the drum on a phony issue on a problem that's already been solved, whereas the other party is saying, wait a minute, you guys aren't serious about solving the main problems that you say you want to solve, but you shut us out, and every time you let us in, you hang us out to dry, and we have to deal with an incompetent president who doesn't know what he wants. So,
yeah, I mean, I would phrase it slightly differently, but first of all, I obviously agree with everything you just said, but as far as I'm concerned, Senator McConnell, a couple months ago, looked around, saw a dire political situation. He saw a real threat that they were going to lose the House and potentially the Senate. The president's approval rating was in the toilet and wasn't going to change anytime soon. And, you know, this issue over DACA has provided McConnell an opportunity to score points in this, you know, in the respective states that they're concerned about, and also, you know, in the national debate as well. You know, since for the last couple months, he's been moving to try and negotiate or to push the Senate in a direction where we have these series of shutdown threats over this particular issue. Again, something that the president claimed to want to deal with, Speaker Ryan claimed to deal with, the McConnell claimed to deal with, simply hasn't gotten done. And I think it's because they've been holding it hostage because they want to try and use it to provide some red meat to their base.
Well, just in closing then, can Claire McCaskill, Tom Donnelly, and others get around this problem? I know they were all effectively allowed to vote with the Republicans by Schumer, but is it going to work? I mean, what do you think?
I don't know. Those are the group that I referred to earlier when I said there's all sorts of meetings going on with moderates right now. Those two in particular and some of the others are the ones that are actually doing the negotiating, doing some negotiating as we speak. Whether it leads to anything remains to be seen. Again, among other things, it's very difficult to imagine anything getting out of the House, much less the Senate. So we'll just have to wait and see. But, you know, the longer conventional wisdom is the longer this goes on, the more difficult it is to try and cut a deal. Having said that, if I was McConnell, I would have this play out over the next 24 to 48 hours because, again, you know, they want to make Democrats bleed over this outrageous allegation that they're doing it simply to benefit illegal immigrants. So we'll have to, but having said that, we'll have to wait and see how it plays out. But there's still some more twists and turns to go in the next 24 hours or so.
Well, Jim Manley, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back assessing the growing crisis with two NATO allies at loggerheads as Turkish jets pound the U.S.'s Kurdish allies in the Syrian-Turkish border area, while Turkey surrogates in the Free Syrian Army, along with Turkish troops, launch a ground offensive. They tried to steal my vision. This ain't a culture, it's my religion. God knows I don't want to go prison. But if a man want to try me, trust me, listen. Me and my G's ain't scared of police. We don't listen to no politician. Everybody on the same mission, and we don't care about your ism and schisms. Because it's shut down. That's not me, and it's shut down. Ring, ring, pussy, it's shut down. Fashion week, and it's shut down. Went to the show, sitting in the front row in a black tracksuit, and it's shut down. Touched the road, and it's shut down. Boy, you better know, and it's shut down. You want to act like a G for the camera. أكتب وخط بالقلم بالقلم أكتب وخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي وعسيني Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Max Hoffman, the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, where his research focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Hoffman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Max. And are we, well, should we be concerned or alarmed that two NATO allies are at loggerheads? I mean, the U.S. has an important Air Force base there they share with Turkey as a NATO member in Incirlik, not far from where this Free Syrian Army, I mean, where the Kurdish, the YPG, which the U.S. has supported, they've been the only effective fighting force, the only boots on the ground that would take on the Assad Russians and the Iranians, and they've proved successful. We're hearing from our military that the U.S. wants to maintain this force for the long term in this region, but now you've got Turkey's leader, Erdogan, vowing to strangle this force at birth. So the U.S. and Turkey are not on the same page.
No, certainly. They're far from the reading from the same script at this point, Ian. And this is sort of the culmination of several years of real tension between the U.S. and Turkey over Syria policy. The issue at stake here, as you mentioned, in a broad sense, is the U.S.'s support for Syrian Kurdish fighters, the YPG, which is part of a larger militia called the SDF that the U.S. has sought to build up, that to include non-Kurdish forces as well. The narrow crisis right now is focused on one of three Kurdish cantons in northern Syria. This one is called Afrin. And the Afrin YPG has actually not been supported by the United States. So there are no U.S. forces there. The U.S. hasn't supplied this particular group of Kurdish fighters. But Turkey has viewed them as a very serious threat for a long time. In fact, the Afrin YPG have had closer ties to the Russians and to the Syrian regime. But Turkey views all of these Kurdish forces as a real national security. They've been warning for quite a while, for over a year, that they might move militarily on Afrin. And now it seems Erdogan has made good on the threat. As I said, in a narrow sense, there aren't U.S. forces or direct interests at stake. The problem is that the Syrian Kurds do share broad goals of federal autonomy in, you know, post-war Syria. And the risk is that this move on Afrin, in addition to causing a humanitarian catastrophe, could spark a wider war between the Turks and Kurdish forces that the U.S. is involved with in other parts of Syria, as well as inflame Turkish-Kurdish conflict and fighting within Turkey itself. So this is a very complicated and dicey situation where the prospects of escalation into either a conflict between Turkey, a broad conflict between Turkey and the Kurds, or between Turkey and the Syrian regime, are high, and also the risks of accidental clashes that perhaps, you know, a U.S. soldier gets caught in the crossfire, that sort of thing, those risks become very real. So it's very disconcerting. It's a very brash move by Erdogan, but no surprise there.
So let's focus then on this Afrin group of Kurds. This is something I'm learning for the first time, that they are, I guess they're more allied. Are they allied with the PKK, who the Turks are adamantly against?
That's right. So Turkey has, for 30-plus years, faced a domestic Kurdish insurgency led by the PKK. Turkey views the Syrian Kurdish forces, the YPG, as basically a branch, the Syrian branch of the PKK. There's an element of truth to that, in that these are leftist Kurdish insurgents. They share recruitment. They share some supply chains with the PKK. The PKK is certainly very influential. But this is also a different environment in Syria, in which the YPG has essentially, you know, taken over charge of local security and actually done a decent job protecting the local population. The Turks say that they have forced non-Kurds to move from their villages. There's a pretty complicated history there. It's kind of hard to tease out exactly what's happened. But Turkey views all of these Kurds in one basket, basically. And they are maneuvering. They're concerned. They have an eye on the post-war Syria. They fear that if they don't act as they are acting now, there will be effectively a Kurdish autonomous statelet along Turkey's southern border. They fear that from that statelet, the PKK or affiliated Kurds could launch attacks into Turkey and support the PKK insurgency within Turkey. And so that's where Erdogan's very, you know, strong rhetoric comes from, that they'll you know, strangle this at birth. The U.S. views it differently. They've been the U.S. has been focused on countering ISIL. The Kurds, as you mentioned, are very effective on that front. They also, the U.S. is focused on de-escalating the conflict, so the Kurds have been able to, you know, hold territory, stabilize it. The civilians in those areas are treated reasonably well, and the U.S., you know, sort of thinks that they can work with the Kurds, they can be a moderating influence, and help stitch together a more peaceful situation in the hopes of some, you know, lasting political settlement in the future with the regime and the Russians and every other player in this conflict. But the, you know, President Erdogan clearly, for a few reasons here, which we can get into, his patience ran out. The U.S. had been urging restraint for 2 years, and Erdogan had largely held off, and now he's gone in. So we'll see where the next phase of this conflict takes us.
But if this group that the Turks are pounding now, and that elements of the Free Syrian Army are also working with alongside Turkish troops in a ground offensive, if they are PKK oriented as well as having dealt with the Russians and the Iranians, and they're not a part of the YPG and the broader SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces that the U.S. support, then it doesn't sound like any great loss. I mean, unless their Kurdish brethren feel that you know, solidarity with these people.
That's right. So the Afrin YPG had partners with the Russians and with the Syrian regime. The Russians, it appears, have basically hung them out to dry. I think what happened on the Russian front is that Russia basically traded the Afrin YPG for a carte blanche in pursuing Turkish-backed rebels in Idlib province to the south. So Russia basically, it's clear that senior Turkish officials visited Moscow earlier this week to basically, you know, seal the deal. The Turks have been flying fighter aircraft into Syria, which the Russians had to allow given their dominance of that part of Syrian airspace. So clearly a deal has been worked out between Ankara and Moscow on this front. What that means is that the Afrin YPG's only friend is the Syrian regime at this point. And it's likely that this Turkish move will push them into the arms of the Syrian regime. You know, that probably is not in, well, certainly not in U.S. interest. It's not in Turkish interest either, but that's going to be one likely outcome. They may, in fact, even, you know, try and invite the Syrian regime to reoccupy parts of Afrin to protect them from the Turkish offensive. The real risk, you know, the U.S., you're right, the U.S., the Pentagon this week said, listen, these Afrin YPG are not the guys we've been working with. They basically said, these aren't our guys. They're on their own almost. The difficulty is not so much the narrow Afrin YPG. The difficulty is, first, as I mentioned, the humanitarian cost here. There are hundreds of thousands of civilians in this area, and this is going to be, you know, a hard-fought campaign if it continues. And the other thing is, the Syrian Kurds do share long-term political goals across all three cantons across northern Syria. And this offensive will enrage Syrian Kurds and Turkish Kurds to the point where it's likely that we'll see attacks on Turkish forces or Turkish-backed rebel forces in other parts of Syria. And I'm thinking now of Manbij to the east and also east of the Euphrates along the Turkish border. And this border, you know, there are outposts every 100 meters or so with Turkish soldiers and armored vehicles. And also within Turkey, there are, of course, lots of soft Turkish targets. And it's very possible that Kurdish insurgents will start targeting these outposts. You know, of course, everyone hopes that it doesn't escalate in this way. And certainly the U.S. has been and will continue to be urging restraint from, you know, on both the Turkish side and the Kurdish SDF YPG side. But, you know, these are people who will be seeing their brethren shelled and bombed by Turkish forces in Afrin, and there's only so much influence the U.S. has here.
Just to talk about the broader post-Syria, post-Iraq situation, and unless, of course, this thing inflames the Syrian war even more and it gets worse, which is not entirely off the table, as far as I can tell. But just to look forward here to the idea, as much as Turkey hates the idea of the Kurds having this state along their southern border that could link up with the Kurdish regions in Iraq, isn't that the long-term, should be, I would think, the long-term goal of the U.S. and others, and Israel in particular as well, to have a... First of all, they're the only forces that have stood up to Assad, the Russians and the Iranians, and then the only useful forces that fought with the U.S. or along with our special forces to liberate Mosul, etc. in Iraq. We know that Iraq is pretty much, thanks to Bush and company, Rumsfeld, Rice, the whole gang, basically handed over Iraq to Iran. So Iran, Russia, they've got the Iranians have almost got the Shia crescent into Lebanon. Wouldn't it make sense, if you're not going to give up the entire region, to sort of build on what you have left, which are the Kurds?
You know, there's a lot of disagreement on that question. What I'd say is, the U.S. is still thinking about, it has a one Iraq policy. The U.S. is committed to trying to keep Iraq together. That means that the Kurdish the Kurdish regional government, the autonomous Kurdish region in the north, the U.S. has applied a lot of pressure, most recently and dramatically after their independence referendum, a lot of pressure on the Kurds to try and work things out with Baghdad and basically have a federal system. Within Syria, nobody has outlined an end state for Syria in any detail that appears realistic yet. But what seems apparent is that Syria will not be put back together the way it was before. There are, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, millions displaced. Understandably, the various ethnic and religious groups are going to need some security guarantees, and likely they'll find it difficult to live together in a unified Syria. Given that fact, I think that the Syrian Kurds understandably have been demanding essentially federal autonomy as part of any post-war Syria. The U.S. hasn't explicitly endorsed that. They've said that the Kurds must have a seat at the table. They must have some degree of local control. Whether that's an independent sort of Kurdistan, certainly beyond that, if it's an independent and unified Kurdistan across Syrian and Iraqi Kurdish areas, that's really a question that perhaps might be, it might be unreachable given all of the interests and the regional powers who would oppose such a goal. But the Kurds have, I think, legitimate demands that they have political autonomy within these countries. They also have very troubled histories in both countries. Both Syria and Iraqi central governments have really oppressed the Kurds for decades, and it's not unreasonable. The Kurds don't trust them anymore.
Right. Well, the Kurds were sold out by Henry Kissinger and the Shah, and my fear is that they'll get sold out again. I mean, and not to mention that they also have sort of divisions between these kind of rival mafia families, the Barzanis and the Talibanis, and the Talibanis just sold out the Kurds on giving up Kirkuk, where their oil lifeline is, right?
They did indeed. And I mean, one of the things that, this is a complicated situation, even when you think of the sort of, quote, the Kurds as a unified bloc. But as you mentioned, they're not. The Syrian Kurds are divided amongst themselves, but are generally, more of the dominant groups anywhere are leftist Kurdish groups. Within the KRG in Iraq, the dominant party in the north near Erbil is sort of a conservative Kurdish family, the Barzanis that you mentioned. And then in Sulaymaniyah and Kirkuk, it's a different Kurdish family, the Talibanis, who are sort of more leftist again. So this is a very complicated dynamic and really, extremely localized control for these various parties. So, the idea of an independent and unified Kurdistan has been a dream for many Kurds for many decades, but is very far from reality. The issue here really for the U.S. is Turkey's behavior at this point. Erdogan, he's launched this offensive. There's a chance if it's a limited offensive and it just, as many, as I expect actually, if it's just to reassert control over this string of villages that the Kurds seized from Turkish-backed rebels 2 years ago, then perhaps this can be managed to sort of a stalemate. Erdogan can declare victory for his, you know, very strong nationalist constituency at home and perhaps strengthen his position vis-a-vis the Russians and the regime in the negotiations towards a, you know, post-war settlement. And everybody can go back to trying to get to sort of a live and let live situation. But if he really is bent on wiping out Afrin and wiping out the Kurdish presence across Turkey's southern border, that's a completely unachievable goal that will spark years of fighting and, you know, tremendous bloodshed and human disruption and upheaval. And at that point, if he really pursues that more ambitious and bloody goal, the U.S. will have some very difficult questions to consider regarding its relationship with Turkey, of course, a NATO ally, as you mentioned right at the start.
Well, of course, at this point, the Russians and the Assad regime are angry with the Turks. So the U.S. is not really as alarmed, but as you say, it could get worse, and then they would be going after the very people that the U.S. Have supported, who've been the only effective boots on the ground, and who the U.S. wants to have a long-term presence with. Thanks for joining us, Max. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me in.
And again, I've been speaking with Max Hoffman, who's Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, where his research focuses on the Turkish and Kurdish regions. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how much the North Koreans have done an end run around Trump's belligerent rhetoric by sending their Olympic team under a common flag to South Korea. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kent Harrington, who's the president of the Harrington Group, that provides political economic analysis and forecasting on markets abroad. A former senior CIA analyst, he served as the National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and Chief of Station in Asia. And he has an article at MediaVillage.com, Why the News Needs to Deconstruct Trump's Dangerous Jingoism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kent Harrington.
Well, thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thanks, Kent. And of course, much focus is on the dysfunction in Washington, but part of it, of course, is our foreign policy dysfunction. And our president, of course, has talked about Fire and Fury, which, of course, has become the title of a book that's very critical of him. Fire and Fury was a threat against North Korea, but the people who would be consumed by Fire and Fury are the citizens of Seoul in South Korea. But it seems to be that there's a kind of detente underway, particularly with this North Korean delegation coming to the Olympics under a common flag. A North Korean pop singer has got everybody in South Korea all in a kind of frenzy, a K-pop type of frenzy. So is this a case that Kim Jong-un has done an end run around Donald Trump with a charm offensive?
Well, I think that's certainly a part of it in a very short-term tactical sense, but I would step back a pace or two and look at what's transpiring under President Moon and basically say what you're witnessing is the consequences of a fundamental divergence between Trump administration policies and particularly the Trump pronouncements, which have threatened everything from nuclear preemptive strikes to all-out war, and the approach that the Moon government and I would say the vast majority of South Koreans would prefer, which is, for lack of a better term, continuing the march with efforts to reach out as well as to contain North Korea, particularly in order to find some way to respond to, counteract, and hopefully at some point draw into some kind of arms control and nuclear-related agreement their nuclear weapons ambitions. The second thing I would say is that you're witnessing the fact that we do not have the influence over this issue that the president's pronouncements would lead perhaps many American people to believe. South Korea is a country that has the primary stake, the neighborhood to include Japan, and of course China have an enormous role to play. The American role is, to be sure, to lead as the leading strategic power in the region, but that means literally cooperation and coordination with our allies. And if there is anything that distinguishes this administration's approach to alliances in general around the world, it is anything but cooperation and coordination.
So, obviously, there's been a tremendous change in Trump's rhetoric during the campaign against China as the great cheater, and suddenly he has a love fest down in Mar-a-Lago with Xi Jinping, and there's an assumption that a lot of this is to do with North Korea. But on the other hand, the U.S. reliance on China getting our irons out of the fire on the Korean Peninsula have always seemed kind of chimeric, because there's no love lost, as far as I can tell, between the Kim Jong-un regime in North Korea and the Chinese, and the fact that Kim killed his uncle and his older half-brother in such a spectacularly gruesome and brazen way would indicate that he was signaling to the Chinese, because they were close to China, both of them. One of them was under the protection of the Chinese. So what's going on there? Because it seems to me that if you talk about regime change in North Korea, the only people that could engineer that would be the Chinese, and I don't even know that they, one, have the intention to do so, or two, have the capability.
Well, I think you've characterized the current state of play between Beijing and Pyongyang very well. I think there's also a historical context. The relations between the two leaderships have began going downhill after the death of Kim Il-sung. His relationship with the Chinese, also one that was rocky at times, was far closer than the relationship that his son, Kim Jong-il, had, and certainly almost an embrace compared to the relationship with Kim Jong-un. There's a couple things here that are worth bearing in mind. First, this is not the first administration to peddle the idea that the Chinese could and would use their leverage in our interest to bring North Korea not just to the table, but to the kind of policy positions on things like nuclear and missile developments that we're seeking. Beijing's interests in Korea and ours, frankly, are not the same. The Chinese basically want to see a Korea that, whatever regime is in charge, is stable and a buffer on their border between them and South Korea, which they view first and foremost in a strategic sense as a U.S. ally. The idea that regime change in the North would benefit them fundamentally is one that falls on the cutting room floor in Beijing because of the fact that no Chinese leadership, certainly not Xi Jinping, wants to see a U.S. Ally on China's border. The second thing I would suggest is that even though the Chinese have responded to U.S. pressures, not just the kind that this administration has tried to exert to have them apply sanctions more strongly from time to time, it's happened with respect to previous administrations when they've approached the Chinese. These are very, very carefully modulated by the Chinese. If we are expecting the Chinese to literally turn off the tap, for example, with energy supplies, we're smoking something. It's not happened in the past. It's not going to happen this time. The third thing I would say, and this is what people, I guess, in a way would have a hard time looking at if they didn't study North Korea carefully. I certainly don't think this is on the front page of the newspapers every day. But there's virtually nothing that the North Koreans have done this to sustain themselves over the last 30 or 35 years in areas that have essentially led to them being considered a criminal state that doesn't involve China. If you look at everything from counterfeiting to illicit weapons transfers to the manufacture and distribution of amphetamines in Asia, which, by the way, the North Koreans are the major manufacturers of, virtually all of these activities are in league with the Chinese. And this illegal and illicit flow isn't just simply a matter of finding crooks in China. It involves the complicity of the Chinese security services as well as Chinese organized crime, which is connected to the security services. So when you look at the kind of warp and woof of these relationships, you really have to take account of the fact that what you see on the surface, even the political level at the senior-most ranks, isn't necessarily indicative of how the two countries, their economies, and their various components interact. Last but not least, I would not underestimate the fact that 70 years plus after the Korean War, there are ties between China and North Korea that we don't see. Let's face it, they both have one primary adversary in Asia. That's us. When you think about it, and when you think of things like intelligence cooperation, it's only logical that there would be some level of cooperation between the two, which also means there's a level of communication politically. So I would just simply be very, very cautious, as your summary suggested, about reaching any conclusions with respect to how far the Chinese are willing to go down the road to carry our water on either of these issues.
So how does that analysis then apply to Russia? Because the Chinese do seem to be cooperating with the latest ramped up UN sanctions against the North. And even though there's a lot of oil and gasoline smuggling going on and tankers offshore, most of those have, so far that have been caught have not really, they've had some Chinese connection, but they've also had Taiwanese connections as well. So it's all about the sort of underworld as far as I can tell. But in terms of Russia, we know that even though my assumption is that notwithstanding what you just said, Kent, the relationship the U.S. has with China is a more deeper economic relationship with deeper ties than Russia. Russia's under sanctions, and there's a lot of hostility about Putin's likely, if not certain, role in manipulating our elections. So there's no question that things are rocky between the U.S. and Russia, and I'm sure Putin is not going to help us at any turn. He's certainly not doing that in Syria. So is Putin going to do something to stitch up the U.S. in that neighborhood? He seems to be basically ignoring the sanctions and working with North Korea.
Well, it's an absolutely critical question, and it falls under the broad heading, from my point of view, of "quote unquote" watch this space. I think the kind of unfolding policies, if you will, in the West as well as in the area we're looking at in the East, that the Russians are pursuing does not bode well for future cooperation with respect to North Korea, or for that matter, with respect to the military balance in East Asia. And I'd only cite a couple facts. Number one, we know, and it's been publicized in a number of very interesting news reports that appear quite credible, that the Russians have had a role to play, directly or indirectly, through Ukraine-related technology and transfer of weapons-related information to North Korea, and perhaps directly with the participation of their own scientists in the wake of the fall of the Soviet Union, that the Russians have had a role in the development of the North Korean missile systems that today are showing an intercontinental capability. So the history is there. There is of sub rosa cooperation. The question is it something that Putin is going to press? It would seem to to me that the signs are pointing in the direction of a yes answer. Why? It's a low-budget investment for Putin in a part of the world where clearly, because of the North Korean nuclear issue, we are under pressure to move with our allies to try to solve a very difficult problem, which this administration's position, frankly, has characterized in ways that make a resolution on its terms impossible. Ultimately, North Korea is going to be recognized as a nuclear state de facto. We recognize that already. So from the viewpoint of Putin's ability to make trouble, in the same way he makes trouble, so to speak, in the Baltic with provocative military activities that attempt to test and show whether or not the U.S. has the resolve to meet its NATO defense commitments, I think we're going to see more provocation simply because it's ripe in Asia for that kind of Russian activity. The second thing I would say is that Russian ties with China in a military-to-military, I would assume, intelligence service-to-intelligence service manner are getting closer. And given Xi Jinping's more assertive posture towards both the United States and China's role in Asia, I think there is a larger area for the two to cooperate tactically, if not strategically, vis-a-vis the United States. It's obviously not going to be something that is going to dramatically change the military balance, and there's a history of antagonism that's very well known, so I'm not pointing in the direction with my comments of any sort of renewed Sino-Soviet-style alliance a la the 50s. But what we do see are two people who are clearly very opportunistic in their leadership behavior, and that's Xi and Putin. And we see the opportunity for them to be able to capitalize on the pressures that we're under and some of the self-inflicted wounds that this administration in particular has begun to show as a result of its behavior towards not only South Korea but towards other allies, not to mention the European. On issues of this sort.
So from Putin's point of view, this is a win-win and a low cost. If he surreptitiously helps the North Koreans with missile development and possibly nuclear development as well, and they certainly have made extraordinary strides very quickly and very much on the cheap. Is this a situation like, for example, the relationship that Hezbollah has to Iran, where Iran gets deterrence against Israel by having Hezbollah threaten Israel? Is that what it is? A deterrence on the cheap? In other words, having a nuclear-armed North Korea helps Russia because it drives the U.S. crazy, and to some extent it helps China because it drives the U.S. crazy and threatens its military assets in the Northeast Pacific.
Well, I'm not sure that the Russians would necessarily draw the conclusion that a nuclear armed and fully operationally capable North Korea would be net in their strategic interests, because the North would de facto play the role as a defensive ally vis-a-vis us. I honestly don't think, strategically speaking, they are looking at the North in those terms. Part of the reason I say that is, like the Chinese, they too have had their experience with North Korean leaders who, to include the current scion of the Kim dynasty, all put an enormous premium on their independence of action. So from the viewpoint of the best the Russians, and I'm just inferring now from their historic behavior in the last 20 years or so, but also current events, probably the best construction the Russians would put on the value North Korea offers to them is that, just as you were suggesting a moment ago, it's a way to put the needle in us, but also to complicate our strategic calculus. It is not going to be a nuclear capability in Pyongyang's hands that threatens Russia. It won't threaten China. It does threaten the U.S. and its allies, unsettling people in both Japan and South Korea, as well as elsewhere in the region, and calling into question, depending on how the U.S. responds to this, how reliable the U.S. deterrent is. that kind of question, you know, the kind in the old days of the Cold War that was asked, you know, would Washington sacrifice a Chicago for a Frankfurt in a nuclear exchange with the old Soviet Union? Those sorts of questions obviously are going to be on the minds of people as they look at how we approach this nuclear issue. So backing up just a step, I would say, I have my doubts that Putin sees this in strategic terms, a la the Hezbollah example that you provided, but I do believe that this is something that is extraordinarily useful to him and why he will continue to meddle.
Well, just in closing then, there is something in common with all of these regimes, Putin's, Kim Jong-un, and Xi Jinping's, and that is that there is an enormous layer of criminal kleptocracy. The North Korean regime is totally criminal. It's a family-run mafia state that only cares about its own survival. And as you can see, no matter how much they get sanctioned, they find ways to make money on the side through counterfeiting and drug dealing, etc. Russia is a kleptocracy, a slightly more sophisticated one with a regulated, Putin regulating the oligarchs, but they're looting the country, him and his cronies, the Siloviki. And then on the Chinese side, there's obviously a lot of corruption, and the leader is trying to sort of stamp it out at the same time using anti-corruption as a way to punish his political enemies. And meanwhile, capital's flying out of that country, leaking like a sieve. So how would you rate the element of criminality? Because my sense is this is the great challenge on the globe, is to deal with the battle between democracy and authoritarian kleptocracy. And this is why I find our president so alarming, because he has such a soft spot for autocrats and kleptocrats.
Well, I wouldn't change a word that you said about the nature of shall we say the criminal element or the nature of corruption and criminality in these regimes, and each varies. The question is, just as you suggest, what is the best means for the United States and its allies to posture themselves to deal with what is going to be a very long pull, if one looks at the prospects for Putin's rule, Xi's rule, and a North Korea that, whether it's under Kim Jong-un or someone else, has proven to be quite resilient over the years. I think what we're really talking about is the ability of the United States to articulate in the 21st century what it articulated so well for much of the 20th, and that is values that we place in democratic process, human rights, and the commitment that we have to attempting to aid countries as they evolve in applying the rule of law and an open political systems. This isn't just simply fluff. To the extent that we do indeed find ourselves perceived as, unfortunately, this current president has led us to be perceived as being indifferent to these issues, if not in some cases almost supportive, I think we are losing an enormously powerful arrow in our quiver. So yes, indeed, organizing a policy around the question of values and what America stands for has got to be one of the foundation stones, if the key foundation stone, in how we position ourselves to make sure our alliances are strong, make sure we have people who are on the same page in the script as we are in terms of the initiatives we need to deal with very difficult problems like the North Korean nuclear and missile challenge, which we indeed do need to confront, do need to contain, and do need to find a way to deal with in order to guarantee security in Asia as well as for the United States.
Well, Kent Harrington, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Kent Harrington, who's president of the Harrington Group, that provides political economic analysis and forecasting on markets abroad. A former senior CIA analyst, he served as national intelligence officer for East Asia, chief of station in Asia, and he has an article at MediaVillage.com, Why the News Needs to Deconstruct Trump's Dangerous Jingoism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Martz. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.